This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. McDonald's has announced it would raise wages for non-managerial positions from $11 to $17 an hour. And Chipotle has also announced it's raising pay. That restaurant aims for an average of $15 an hour by the end of the month. We are talking about the meaning of minimum wage, and we're taking it in context with a broader economy where millions are unemployed, yet businesses are struggling to find workers. What do you see? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Do you make minimum wage right now in Wisconsin? How would a pay increase affect your life? Maybe you run a business. How do you decide how much you can pay employees? And can you bump that up? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Joanna Marinaska is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Pennsylvania. She's an economist who studies the labor market, and she's here to help us break it down. Joanna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
I'm happy to be here.
Help us understand what the economic benefits are when businesses raise the minimum wage.
So very simply, when businesses are trying to hire and have difficulties hiring, one of the things that they can do that is most straightforward, I think, for our listeners to understand is simply to pay people more, because that makes the job, whatever the job is, much more attractive. And therefore, they will have less trouble finding workers when they're paying more. And for McDonald's, we have to remember that other companies, other big companies that hire workers such as Amazon or Target or Best Buy already committed to $15 an hour minimum wage, and therefore McDonald's has to compete with those other companies that oftentimes were paying more, and that would make it harder to hire. So now they're following up, on some of those minimum wages announced by others, which will allow them to hire more workers.
But once you do that and you raise all of those wages across different organizations, aren't you in a similar starting place then, just $5 an hour higher, where the competition is much closer?
Well, you are raising the wage. That means that you're able to, from a business perspective, these companies are doing this because overall it makes sense. That means that on balance, what they're able to make as far as their profitability is better with this decision than what they were doing before. Because again, before, the problem is they were having hiring difficulties. And this is not the limit here, is it's not arbitrary, is how much the worker ultimately is worth to the company, how much the worker contributes to the bottom line. A worker cannot be paid more, basically, that's what basic economic theory tells us, than their contribution to production. And what that means is that before these increases, many workers were likely paid less. They were paid less than their worth, so there was some room to move up. That's what the increases really tell us.
What are the reasons businesses resist raising that minimum wage?
Right. So the key reason here is that the businesses naturally prefer to make those decisions depending on the particular circumstances of the business, because it makes sense for some businesses to raise wages. It might be the best strategy, again, given what other competitors are doing and they can afford it. So they want to definitely do it in some cases. In some other cases, it's not necessarily clear that, they need to raise wages to attract more workers. Maybe this job where they are already gets enough workers, so they prefer to keep wages low and make more profit and not be forced to raise wages. So for businesses, it's always better to have the choice whether they want to raise the wages because they really need more people or keep the wages low and make more profit, and it works okay this way. So that's why, again, it makes a lot of sense for businesses not to want to have the minimum wage increase. The businesses that want that are those that already pay really high wages, so it doesn't affect them. It only affects their competitors who are paying less and potentially annoying other companies who pay less. So again, from a business perspective, it kind of makes sense. They just want to have the choice whether they want to raise wages or not.
We are talking about the current labor market with economist Joanna Marinaska, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We're wondering, what would raising the minimum wage, whether federally or just at different companies where you might get a job, what would that mean to your family? Maybe you run a business or you have to make hiring decisions and salary decisions. What goes into that? And what do you think about this move that you're seeing companies add dollars per hour to employees' wages? You can call now at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Ioana, it sounds like then that when you see Chipotle and McDonald's and Amazon, you know, we also heard last month Olive Garden upped its pay to at least $10 an hour for 20% of the chain staff. It sounds like these companies will afford it because they just will make less profit off of each person that they're employing. How are they going to account for that? Or are there other areas where they're going to have to make up for this when they pay employees more an hour?
Right. So they are going to make less profit if they don't change anything apart from mm-hmm. that. And, you know, McDonald's, I want to point out, had things in place that allowed them to underpay workers, such as preventing workers from working at other McDonald's franchises without authorization. So this way they would limit competition between different McDonald's, not allowing them to poach workers. So what's going to happen is that, first of all, they will make up some of the lost profits through decrease in hiring costs. Again, they're able to hire more workers without putting in the effort to search. And importantly, workers are less likely to quit because the jobs are better. And one of the big costs of business in this kind of industries is turnover. I mean, it's very expensive for workers to always quit. You're always trying to hire another person. So some of the cost is being recouped simply by having people stay longer in the job, and that often also allows them to do a better job. So it's not completely a loss. And then the rest, well, it really depends on the specific of the situation. In some cases, they might raise prices a little bit. It really all depends on the specific market that the firm is in.
Sure. So they're trying to balance what they can do for employees while still making sure that they make a solid profit. We've got Joanne in Madison ready to join our conversation. Good morning, Joanne.
Hi, good morning. My not concern, but I feel a little mixed emotion about the whole thing because I have worked for my current employer for the past 30 years, and I started at about $9 an hour. And I only make about $18.50 at this point. So there's this pull at me that says the minimum wage actually, or the wages, should have been going up over the past years.
Right.
Overall, you know, it's so ridiculous. For myself, it comes out to be about 25 cents per hour per year increase.
That you're thinking about. Joanne, thank you for bringing that up, because that is a challenge for workers. Joanne's story, Ioana, people have worked in jobs. They haven't seen the kind of increases. And now suddenly companies are saying we're going to add lots of money to people's paychecks. That can be difficult to process. What's the economic side of that?
Right. So it turns out that wages have increased very little since 1980 once you account for the cost of living. And I'm talking here about the wages of average people have increased very, very little. And while at the same time, the productivity has increased a lot. And again, the productivity is essentially what workers could be paid. That's, you know, what they're contributing to the firm's bottom line. And so what's happening here, what we found in economics, is that a lot of the reason for that is that there is rising inequality, and essentially a lot of the pay increases, instead of going to your listeners, people like your listeners that, you know, she just spoke, are going to CEOs and top executives in firms. And so that's, we found, is a big reason for what's happening here, that people aren't getting raises, most people, most ordinary people, but top, you know, managers and executives are. And that's a big reason behind this trend. And so right now, by raising the wages at the bottom, they are finally, companies who choose to do this are a little bit rebalancing things as far as how they pay employees at different places in the pay scale.
What's the minimum wages relationship to poverty in America as you talk about inequality increasing?
Right. So many people who make the minimum wage and are working are still below the poverty line, depending, you know, how many hours a week they are working. And therefore, research shows by Erin Dubé, for example, that raising the minimum wage will reduce poverty. And the reason is that there are very few job losses. You always fear that if you raise the minimum wage, it's going to lead to job losses. But that's not the case typically. And therefore, the main result is that the people who are working minimum wage get a pay bump, and that then reduces poverty.
Ioana Marinescu is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Pennsylvania, and we're talking about the minimum wage and the broader labor market here on the Ideas Network. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about rising minimum wages? What do you want to say about how the federal government manages this? Do you think that there's something here that can help remedy inequality? Or do you see challenges with the idea? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. This discussion continues here on The Morning Show. Companies in Wisconsin and around the country are looking for workers, and some big names are saying they're setting their minimum wages higher than the government requires. It's just one incentive to lure workers as those businesses struggle to fill positions. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest, Ioana Marinescu, is helping us break down what's going on in the labor market. She's an economics assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Kimberly in Fox Lake is thinking about this. Hey, Kimberly.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my question. So, there are these people that are taking minimum wage. They're, like, in the affordable housing. As the minimum wage increases, I don't know if that's going to bump them out of that affordable housing bracket, because then their rent is going to go from, like, $400, $600 a month to they're probably in a place next to their work. It might be a nicer part of town. It's going to go up to, like, $900 or $1,100 a month. How is that? Are they going to look into, like, rental affordable housing brackets? Are they going to adjust those accordingly?
Kimberly, thanks for bringing this up. Ioana, I hear Kimberly thinking about this from the worker's perspective. It'd be great to make more money, and if they don't qualify for protected services anymore, it could actually cost people money in their personal lives. Do you see that?
Right. So indeed, it's possible that people could lose benefits in some cases by making more money. So that's something that has to be taken into account. But still, on average, typically, you still make additional money. Maybe that's reduced by your benefits that you might lose. But on net, most people make additional money. Now, the point that the listener brought up is about rent. And you know, the point is that if wages raise, potentially it could be that the rents that the people who have these wages could raise as well, you know, increase. And that the critical thing there is to make sure that there is enough supply of units, of, you know, houses and apartments. And because if there's not enough supply, what we know from economics, if there's a fixed supply and there's an increase in demand, meaning more people are willing to pay more for housing, then prices go up. So we have to make sure through urban and real estate development policy that there is enough opportunity for developers to build more housing as well as potentially more public housing, so that, you know, we don't experience potentially these increases in rent prices, in rents that are due to more people wanting to get better housing.
We have Lindsay in Westby who's on the line now. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning. My question is in respect to if there's any analysis on if there's health care and dental benefits, long-term disability, and life insurance. I know as hourly wages increase, if there's no benefits, then people have to purchase that insurance. But if there is benefits, that's one reason employers keep those hourly wages a little bit lower, especially if they offer 100% premium coverage. So I'm just wondering if there's a correlation here with benefits.
Lindsay, thanks so much. And before Ioana weighs in on this, Austin in Lafarge has a similar point. Hey, Austin.
Hey, yeah, West he is just down the road, so he must be thinking alike this morning, but wondering how a lack of benefits play into the value of an increased minimum wage, and just wondering if there's a risk of an army of part-time workers that then employers don't have to provide any benefits to, and if this minimum wage increase will kind of be for naught.
Austin, thank you so much. Lindsay, thanks to you too. Joanna, what about the issue of benefits?
So benefits, if people don't have benefits, then raising the minimum wage is clearly a good thing, because that allows them to purchase plans, you know, on the open market, and they have just more money to do that if they choose to get a new plan or a better plan. If the company already has benefits, then it's possible for the company, we're talking about cost savings, it's possible that companies will decrease the value of those benefits in order to make up some of the lost money that they do by paying workers more. So that's something that employees should always be looking out for. If there are things that are happening that the company is now shortchanging them in other ways, even while they're paying higher wages. And certainly that is potentially a margin of adjustment for some employers.
So something to certainly pay attention to. Thanks so much for those calls at 800-642-1234. Joanna Marinuska is here. She's an economist who works at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies employment and productivity and economic security. Joanna, Wisconsin companies, 50 Chamber of Commerce's chambers of commerce from across Wisconsin, they sent a letter to Wisconsin's governor to end federal related unemployment benefit programs. They're saying that additional benefits for unemployment during the pandemic have meant that our state economy is having trouble bouncing back, that people aren't applying for and taking some of the jobs that are available. What's your take on that? Are these increased incentives an incentive for people not to work?
Right. So I actually have done a study on this. And what the study shows is that indeed higher benefits decrease job applications. So that's certainly the case. However, you have to consider the broader picture. So at the same time, higher benefits mean more money in people's pockets and therefore more customers for all these businesses. So there's that side of the coin. Furthermore, if there's not enough jobs out there, it doesn't really help to have more applicants. And that was the case last year at this time. Now this has changed, right? So it can be the case right now that benefits contribute to companies having some trouble hiring. But I want to remind those companies that these benefits also mean customers, you know, for their businesses. So it's certainly a balance to strike. So one thing that I would suggest is to consider, changing the way that the benefits come and allowing people who go back to work to collect the remainder of the federal benefits. So this way, the people who, you know, still can't find a job, they still get the benefits. However, when you go back to work, you don't lose anything essentially, because you get all the remainder of your rights to the federal benefits. So this works as a bonus for people who return to work. Oh, okay, I'm back to work. Right. Now I can immediately get all the rest of the benefits I would have been eligible for if I didn't go back to work, the federal part. So that wouldn't cost Wisconsin anything extra. This is just the federal benefits that the worker would be entitled to.
Interesting. From your perspective, how much of the labor shortage is caused not by those benefits, but by the stimulus payments that have come out? Has that affected our workforce?
Right. So I think the key is that the stimulus payments don't have a direct impact on work, because they you keep them even if you're working. So that's the key thing that people have to understand. So the only reason why the stimulus payments could impact work is because they allow people to avoid crappy jobs, essentially, for a bit. Right. But there's no direct disincentive, because, again, even if you take a job, you still keep the stimulus money. However, the way that it does contribute to the shortage indirectly is because, again, as I was saying, it stimulates consumption. So more people are out there going to restaurants and buying stuff, and that means that the restaurants and the retail places have to hire more people. So in that sense, it does contribute to the shortage simply because it stimulates the economy.
It's all quite complicated. As we look forward, where do you see things working for the United States economy when it comes to labor?
Right. So I think, you know, this is a transition phase where hiring is picking up big time. So naturally, since the applications aren't going up at the same time, it's hard for employers. But eventually things are going to normalize. And I'm very optimistic that come September, you know, when essentially everybody's vaccinated and schools are reopening, because that's another obstacle for people to go back to work, for mothers in particular. So schools will be open, people will be vaccinated, and the benefits anyway end at that point. So I'm very optimistic that come September, things will be looking really bright and up.
Perhaps we'll have to check in with you then. Ioana, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ioana Marinescu is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Pennsylvania. She's an economist who studies the labor market and looks at crafting policies that can enhance employment, productivity, and economic security. Ahead on The Morning Show, we talk with the new chief medical officer and state epidemiologist. She's here to answer your questions about Wisconsin's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and discuss her goals for the Department of Health Services. Stay with us. I'm Keeley Boltina. News is next here on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Our next guest provides health guidance to agencies all around Wisconsin. Dr. Jasmine Zapata is the new chief medical officer and state epidemiologist for community health at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. She's also a physician specializing in pediatrics and preventative medicine. Dr. Zapata, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here.
You are a physician, a newborn hospitalist. What are your goals in this new role as chief medical officer and state epidemiologist?
The vision of Wisconsin DHS is for everyone to live their best life, and I just love that. My goals are to do just that in all that I do and all the medical and public health consultation that I provide. Another focus of mine will definitely be on community healing. We have been through so much. People across Wisconsin have been through so much over this last year. And as we are finding hope and finding a solution and getting near the end of this pandemic, healing both physically and mentally, social and emotionally, spiritually, financially, that will all be important. So one of my big focus will be on community healing. Also, I love meeting people, so I've been having a lot of internal meetings with others in my bureau and department, and also with others across the state and in the community. So I'm very excited about that. And more specifically, I'll be focusing on bringing awareness to many of the amazing programs within the Bureau of Community Health Promotion within DHS, and also focusing a lot on combating racial inequities in maternal child health.
You mentioned you like meeting people and you are meeting with people. How do you balance, thinking about this from a medical perspective with your background and expertise and also really hearing people?
That is a great question. I think that it's so important just to have a conversation. A lot of times, from my personal experience, as a medical doctor, it's a profession that is very highly regarded, and that's great. So sometimes when we come in a room, people might be nervous to talk or think there's a big divide, but there's really not. And so I just love listening and having a conversation, and the way that I approach my patients from as a physician is the same way I approach my community and I approach public health. Instead of someone just coming in and telling you what to do and having thoughts for you, it really should be a conversation where we're collectively working together to help you reach the best outcome for your health and for your life.
Dr. Jasmine Zapata is the new chief medical officer and state epidemiologist for community health for Wisconsin. We're talking about her goals in this role, and we're taking your questions. There's a line for you at 800-642-1422. 1234. What questions do you have for Dr. Zapata? What do you want to share with her to help her understand what you're dealing with at this point in your life and in your community? What do you see when it comes to disparities or places where the state could help? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send that question or your story to ideas@wpr.org if you prefer email. Dr. Zapata, part of your new role is being the primary medical liaison with federal officials and state officials and local agency and organizations. That seems like quite a task. What does that entail for you?
Yes, that entails taking my public health expertise and experience and really bringing the voice from the community and from my experience to help policymakers and decision makers and people who are overseeing important public health operations, help and consult them make the best decision using sound public health practice. So that is what I'll be doing, and I'm just so excited about it. It really is just speaking up for what I believe is right.
That's also a pretty big challenge, at least when it comes to vaccines. You know, we have about 46% of Wisconsinites who've gotten at least the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. But that means about half of the people in our state have not done that. So how are you going to contribute to the efforts to get Wisconsin vaccinated? Or is that a priority for you?
Yes, it's definitely a priority. We know that the vaccines are safe and effective, and we're very proud that we have reached that number of Wisconsinites who have at least received their first vaccine dose. We know that there still is vaccine hesitance, and we need to continue having conversations. That definitely is a priority for me. There are some people who knew immediately that they wanted to get it, and there's others who are still questioning and still have reservations. And that's okay. We need to just continue having conversations to help people get accurate information and talk through whatever hesitations that they have. In my personal experience, that has been very helpful to take the same approach that I use as a medical doctor when we're helping patients decide on if they're going to get a procedure or not, or start a new medication, having an informed consent conversation where we talk about the risk and benefits of whatever that intervention is going to be. And we also talk about what it would look like if they don't get it. And then after hearing their questions or concerns and talking to them, helping them make the best decision for their health. So it's so important to continue to have these conversations. It's also important, and another priority of mine, it's important that when we are talking about the issue of vaccine hesitance, especially among communities of color, which we see some disparities in our vaccine uptake rates right now, it's important to have trusted messengers within the community to continue having these conversations. Over the last year, I've been involved in this a lot, and I plan to continue to be going into churches and at different community events and getting invited into businesses to talk about the vaccine, talk about any questions or hesitations that people have. Also, something I'm very excited about and a priority of mine will be to continue to spread the word about this is that DHS was able to recently give $6.2 million to over 100 community organizations to help facilitate these community conversations. So I'm so excited. I'll be participating in some of those conversations, and that definitely would be a priority. So I'm excited for where we are at, and we still have some work to do, but I'm hopeful.
You talk about those disparities, and they're reflected even in the basic numbers. You know, we talked about almost half of Wisconsinites having been vaccinated, and only 22% of our Black Wisconsinites have. Why is there a gap there?
That's a great question. And you can't bring me on a 30-minute show to talk about that. I need a whole day, week. However, what I will say is that it is definitely multifactorial. This is very complex conversation to talk about. What I will say is that we did not get into this situation overnight of all these inequities, and it's not going to be something that we can undo overnight as well. It's going to take time, and that's okay, but we're going to just keep being vigilant about it. Over just for many historical reasons in our country, there have been reasons that there has been a lack of trust between certain communities of color and the healthcare and public health systems. And again, those things that have happened are serious events, and we can't just snap our fingers and undo that harm that occurred overnight. So we need to do a lot of work to repair that trust. In addition to that, it's been more than just a lack of trust. There have been access issues and then just systemic inequities in our state have contributed as well. And again, those are the reasons for many of the initiatives that we're seeing take place right now to make sure that there's equal access for everyone.
And what, you know, in this role, what are you able to do? What efforts are there underway in the state to try to remove some of those inequities or bridge that gap?
Great question. One of the things that I mentioned earlier, I'm very excited about. It was a grant that DHS gave, and it was just recently. And it was $6.2 million that got distributed to over 100 community organizations to have trusted messengers within the community facilitate conversations about COVID, how to protect yourself against COVID-19. Also about they will be working on how to eliminate some of the barriers that certain communities have experienced. So I am so excited about that. That is a way to help bridge the gap. Also, there's a vaccine matching program that DHS recently started doing as well, which is amazing because any community-based organization or any local organization that wants to provide the vaccine on site, they are helping to pair them with vaccinators. And that in and of itself is pretty amazing for those who want to get the vaccine in a place that they feel more comfortable. There are a lot of people who feel very comfortable getting at their own healthcare provider, but there are others who prefer to get it at a community-based site.
You've talked a couple of times about money from the state to organizations to help facilitate conversations. And I can imagine some people might say, why are we spending money to talk about this? Why is this the best way to convince people or help people health-wise is to schedule time to discuss it? Tell us more about that relationship and why those connections play into public health.
Great question. Again, I'll talk about some stories with me as a physician that it really informs my understanding of public health and how that works. So if we're living in a historic time, it hasn't been for 100 years since we've been in a pandemic of this magnitude, where there are people dying like never before, economic devastations. There is just so much going on, and there are people that are scared in this time. And so for some, it's very easy to just hear the medicine and public health establishment say, take this vaccine, it's safe and effective and we trust it. But there are some people who are hesitant and for various reasons. And one of the things that will drive, in my personal opinion, one of the things that will drive those people who still have questions, will drive them away even more, is if we cast blame or shame or just tell them what to do. Some people really value having conversations so that they can process their feelings, gather correct information, talk about any myths they may have heard or things that may give them pause or caution, and just be a listening ear and have that conversation with them. In my personal experience, I've talked with people who were 100% against it, but after multiple conversations with me over time, just listening to them, letting them know, even if you don't want to make the decision now, I'll be here next week to talk about it as well. I just want to hear your reservations and let's continue this conversation. There were many people that ended up getting the vaccine after that approach. So that's that's why it's so important. This is a very tough time, and we need to respect everyone's decisions and just be there to help them make the right choice.
We are talking with Dr. Jasmine Zapata about her new role as Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Community Health in Wisconsin. There's room for you in this conversation here on the Ideas Network. You can call 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about getting the COVID-19 vaccine? Were you hesitant? Do you have friends and family who are? What do you want Dr. Zapata to know about the life that you live? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show. Dr. Jasmine Zapata is with us here on The Morning Show. She's talking about health issues facing people in Wisconsin, including the pandemic and racial disparities. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. Dr. Zapata is our state's chief medical officer and state epidemiologist for community health. That's within the Department of Health Services. What questions do you have for Dr. Zapata? What do you want her to know about your life? Call 800-642-1234, just like Craig from Stevens Point did. Hi, Craig.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Zapata, Kate, good morning. I have a question about the cost of the vaccine or the vaccine administration. My understanding has been, and I've heard this even on public radio, that these vaccinations for COVID are free to anyone who wants them. I am happy to be vaccinated, as is several of my family. At my local pharmacy yesterday, I was advised that veterans through a certain major prescription chain are being charged $40 copays for the vaccine. And one of my family members who got the vaccine at the UW Stevens Point, the Johnson & Johnson, received recently an $89 administration of the shot fee as a copay through her insurance. Can you explain the costs of the vaccination and why they are not truly free?
Craig, thank you so much for that question. Dr. Zapata.
Yes, thank you for that question. The vaccines are free. They should be free to you. And so if you do get charged or any cost, make sure to call back that agency and let them know. There will be certain times where insurance is charged for things, but it shouldn't trickle down to individuals having to pay. So if that does happen, I do know there have been some errors at times or mistakes where people accidentally got bills, but you should not have to pay. There are places that you can go and you should not have to pay anything at all. In cases, they will bill your insurance, but again, it should not have to come directly to you. You should be able to get it at no cost.
And so what happens, right, if Craig or a family member calls back and they say, hey, the bill is there. I mean, what do you do after you've got the bill and if you don't make headway with a private company?
Mm-hmm. A lot of times there are people that you can call to dispute that charge. So there's so much going on right now. There are so many people getting the vaccine. And so there are going to be some errors or things that slip through the cracks, but just continue calling to dispute. But they definitely should be free and it should not be any cost to you at all.
All right. Craig, thanks for bringing that up. That is a challenge for people, and we appreciate you talking about that. Jessica in Colgate also is ready to join our conversation. Good morning, Jessica.
Hi, good morning. I have some family members who have had COVID, and they're reluctant to get the vaccine because they think they're still protected. This was back in January. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts for them.
Yes. Great question. I'll tell my personal story. I also had COVID back in November of last year, and I did get the vaccine. After that, I got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And what our data is showing is that, yes, you are offered protection after you have a natural infection with COVID-19, but we don't know exactly how long that protection lasts. And over time, we do know that that immunity can wane. So there's still a lot of studies determining exactly how long that protection lasts, but it's unknown. What we do know is that when you do get the vaccine, you do get a robust amount of immunity and protection. And we know that that is longer lasting. There's still a lot of studies looking into this, but we definitely still recommend that you get the COVID-19 vaccine, even if you've had a natural infection with COVID-19.
Jessica, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Jasmine Zapata is the new chief medical officer and state epidemiologist for community health with Wisconsin's DHS. She's also a physician specializing in pediatrics and preventative medicine. You're listening to this conversation on the Ideas Network. Dr. Zapata, you talked about racial disparities when it comes specifically to COVID-19, but you have a background in pediatrics. We know that another racial disparity in Wisconsin is that it has the highest infant mortality rate for African Americans in the country. What should we realize about that? What are we going to do about it?
Great question. Yes, infant mortality, particularly Black infant mortality in Wisconsin, is very high. And one thing that's important to know is that one of the leading causes that is driving that number is complications of prematurity and low birth weight, Black babies being born too early and too soon. And some of the statistics even show that college educated Black women have much higher adverse birth outcomes compared to white women who have not even completed high school. So we know that this is not just an issue with socioeconomic status. Also, there's studies that show that first generation African women that come to the United States, their birth outcomes are pretty similar to white women, but the longer that their generation line is here in the United States, that's when we see these adverse birth outcomes increase, and particularly infant mortality. So it's letting us know it's something going on about being a Black woman in America, and we know that there are impacts of racism that definitely play a role. So we need to approach this issue from many different directions. We need to be able to focus on social determinants of health that impact the woman, Black women across their entire lifespan.
Help us bring us in on this UW grant to pilot a community-based prenatal care model for Black women.
Yes. Are you referring to my research?
Yes.
Oh, great. Yes. So it's really important. One thing that we know is helpful for overall health and well-being is social connection, social connectivity. And the research that I'm doing is hearing the voice of Black women to say, what do you need to feel better connected to your communities, to one another? How can we create a safe space for you to heal from a lot of things that have gone on, particularly in the past year, but even before that? And so I'm doing some one-on-one interviews and focus groups with Black women here in Dane County, just talking about what would it look like to create a safe space. And we have piloted a once a month community support group for Black moms who are thinking of getting pregnant in the next year, currently pregnant, or who recently had a baby, as a safe space to talk with one another and get helpful information.
Thank you for sharing that. And Dr. Zapata, we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. We are going to get through all of this together. It's been a rough year, but we're going to get through this next year together.
Dr. Jasmine Zapata is the new chief medical officer and state epidemiologist for community health at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.